Well, this is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fagrang, and our guest today is Andrew Basevich, who is a retired colonel and a professor of history at Boston University. And he just came out with a book called Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War. Well, Mr. Basevich, welcome to KABU.
Thanks very much for having me on this program.
Well, why don't we just jump right in? It seems to me there's a big theme in the book that goes through all the different chapters, and that is the U.S., the Credo and the Trinity, which sounds kind of religious. So why don't you tell us about that?
Well, the purpose of the book in describing what I'm calling the Washington Rules is to invite readers to recognize the existence of a national security consensus that has shaped our policies really since the earliest days of the Cold War. And I suggest that the consensus really consists of two major components. You just mentioned them, the Credo and the Trinity. The American Credo is an assertion voiced really by every president since Harry Truman, down to and including Barack Obama, that the United States is called upon to lead, shape, save, and transform the world. The Sacred Trinity describes the playbook, really, of how we attempt to employ military power in order to fulfill the obligations imposed by the Credo. And the Sacred Trinity really consists of three components. That's why it's a trinity. The first, the insistence that the United States is called upon to maintain a global military presence. The second, the habit of configuring U.S. forces not to defend the country, but to for global power projection. And the third piece is the marrying of global presence and global power projection capabilities to support a policy of global interventionism. And these three things, presence, power projection capabilities, intervention, really does describe the way we operate in the world and have done so for decades.
Then there's the idea of semi-war, sort of a perpetual war. Can you tell us about that?
Well, semi-war is a term coined by James Forrestal after World War II. Forrestal is a now nearly forgotten figure, but was the first Secretary of Defense.
He was Secretary of War, they used to call it in those days.
Well, he was Secretary of the Navy during World War II, mm-hmm. and then after the war, when Congress passed legislation creating the Department of Defense, he became the first Secretary of Defense.
Okay.
Yeah, and Forrestal was really one of the first major figures in Washington after World War II to not only recognize that the Soviet Union posed a threat, but he was one of the first to really portray that threat in the most dangerous terms. And Forrestal believed that the United States was facing a period of open-ended emergency when, he believed, it would be necessary for us to, in a sense, be permanently mobilized. It was a condition that he believed existed somewhere between real war and actual peace, and he termed that condition semi-war. And I think that the importance of reviving the term today is that this notion of permanent national security crisis that requires the United States to be permanently mobilized persists in Washington, and it persists despite the fact that the Soviet threat that justified this sort of thinking in the first place, of course, is long gone. So we exist in a permanent condition of semi-war. In some respects, we exist in a permanent condition of real war, and the vast majority of the American people, whether they agree with the wars, accept war as now, in essence, a normal condition.
Now we come to sort of two key figures in this military strategy. One is Alan Dulles, and the other is Curtis LeMay. And they represent sort of two poles of military strategy.
Well, again, there are a couple of nearly forgotten figures, I think, mm-hmm. apart from specialists, but fascinating characters. And I think people whose influence continues to the present day in ways that few of us appreciate. Alan Dulles was not the first director of the CIA, but he served as director longer than anybody, really through most of the Eisenhower era and into the Kennedy era. General Curtis LeMay was a very famous Air Force officer. He was the architect of the bombing campaign against Japan in World War II, and he served longer than anybody else as the commander of Strategic Air Command, which during the Cold War was the principal nuclear strike force. And the point of returning to these figures in my book is to try to show the way that institutional purposes or institutional ambitions in some respects perverted, almost hijacked policy, because these two leaders of major institutions, the CIA and the Strategic Air Command, in building up those institutions, helped to create the environment in which the Washington rules came to be deeply embedded in the way Washington thinks and acts. Let me try to be more specific here. That Dulles, as a proponent of covert operations, somebody who believed that he needed to have CIA stations around the world, and not CIA stations not simply there to collect, gather, and analyze intelligence, but CIA stations that would then engage in various dirty tricks, a way of projecting power covertly. And my own view would be that over time, most of the activities undertaken under that rubric have actually been very, to put it mildly, less than helpful in terms of advancing our interests.
And LeMay's strategy was basically bomb the hell out of them.
Well, I mean, in a sense, yes. In a sense, no. I mean, the strategy, the Strategic Air Command insisted that its mission was keeping the peace, but it was keeping the peace by trying to create a nuclear strike force of such overwhelming power that the Soviet Union would be deterred. The problem is, of course, that people like LeMay became so enamored with expanding the size of our nuclear arsenal, of building more bombers, of building more bases, that this process of building an empire took on a life of its own. We end up with tens of thousands of nuclear weapons, and even if you think that nuclear weapons were useful to deter the Soviet Union, we certainly could have achieved that purpose with far fewer than the number of weapons we ended up building. Why do we build them? We built them because people like Curtis LeMay found it useful to continue the process of building them.
So then along came John Kennedy, and he wanted some kind of a idea. He was pushing an idea of flexible strategy. That we sort of be in between these two poles.
Yes, correct? Exactly right. I mean, mm-hmm. if by the time we get to the end of the Eisenhower era, the CIA and SAC, Dulles's handiwork and LeMay's handiwork, mm-hmm. have become the two principal expressions of the two principal instruments for projecting power under the Washington rules. When John Kennedy came into office in 1961, he brought with him into power a group of people who were dissatisfied with these two options, who wanted to have a wider range of options for projecting power. And they styled their program Flexible Response. Flexible Response was derived from the conviction that conventional force, meaning force in that space between covert operations and nuclear warfare. Flexible force insisted that the flexible response insisted that conventional force could become a useful tool of statecraft. Whether counterinsurgency forces or conventional military forces, that these could be not simply held in reserve, but could be actively employed in order to advance American interests. And, I mean, to cut to the chase, it was that kind of thinking that persuaded first John Kennedy and then his successor, Lyndon Johnson, that the Vietnam War not only needed to be waged, but could be waged successfully. That notion, of course, leading us down the path into a disastrous policy failure. But the point of raising that in a book is to suggest that really this is a recurring pattern, that from time to time, Washington is taken by this idea that there really ought to be ways and can be ways to make force in war more usable. And typically, this effort ends up putting us up on the rocks.
Well, now, President Kennedy had some run-ins, certainly with Curtis LeMay, over the Bay of Pigs fiasco, and then later the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yes, especially the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. LeMay was absolutely insistent that there was no alternative to bombing and invading Cuba in order to remove the Soviet missiles that were there. LeMay told Kennedy to his face that anything less than an invasion of Cuba was tantamount to appeasement and would have disastrous consequences. We should be grateful. There's many things I criticize President Kennedy about, but we should be grateful to him that he disregarded that kind of advice from General LeMay and, in fact, did engage him in what was, in essence, a policy of appeasement, of cutting a deal with Nikita Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union at the time, in which Khrushchev agreed to remove the missiles from Cuba. We agreed to refrain from invading Cuba, and we agreed to remove a set of missiles that we had placed in Turkey and Italy that the Soviets found threatening.
Well, you know, I guess you could call it appeasement. In a way, it's like a rational decision.
Oh, I agree. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's very rational. Mm-hmm. But in the context of...
Well, to LeMay, it was appeasement, I'm
to
sure.
LeMay, yeah. And to I mean, the whole notion of bargaining, mm-hmm, with adversaries, of engaging in give and take, is viewed, to the present day, is viewed in some quarters of our country as appeasement.
Well, one interesting thing you, in the book, you say how General Lansdale was, he asked the Pentagon for a sort of pretext that might justify an invasion of Cuba. And they came up. Now, is that Operation Northwoods that the Pentagon came up with?
I know it under the name of Operation Mongoose. Okay. I mean, I just credited Kennedy with wisdom and cool-headedness, mm-hmm, in navigating our way out of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and he deserves great credit for that. But in the wake of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy resumed an effort that he had begun after the Bay of Pigs debacle to try to destabilize the Castro Revolution through sabotage and dirty tricks. This was called Operation Mongoose. In many, mm-hmm, respects, it was Mongoose, begun after the Bay of Pigs fiasco in 1961, that really paved the way for the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, because Mongoose conveyed the message to Castro that the United States was determined to bring him down. In many respects, Castro's willingness to allow Soviet missiles to be installed in Cuba reflected his efforts to defend himself from what he correctly saw as an assault by the United States on his regime. I don't think you need to be an apologist for Castro to see that his behavior was not necessarily something that I would want to justify, but contained a strong element of rationality in it.
Well, this is Fight the Empire, and my guest is Andrew Bacevich, who is a retired colonel and a professor of history, and he's come out with a book, Washington Rules. Well, Operation Northwoods, what I understand, was a list. It was actually a plan put forth by the Joint Chiefs, I think General Lemnitzer, where there would be sort of false flag terror operations. We would shoot down some civilian airliner, blame it on Cuba, things like that. And this is actually presented, I think LeMay signed on to it too. I think all the Joint Chiefs signed on to this and presented it to Kennedy, and he turned it down.
I'm not familiar with that, but it is certainly a fact that in the wake of the Bay of Pigs operation, the Joint Chiefs, the military more broadly, were engaged in detailed planning for an invasion of Cuba. And when General Lansdale, who was working under the direction of Robert Kennedy, President Kennedy had given Robert Kennedy, the Attorney General, principal responsibility for directing Operation Mongoose, General Lansdale, in essence, was Robert Kennedy's chief lieutenant, sort of presiding over the day-to-day operations. As Lansdale came to realize that efforts to overthrow Castro using dirty tricks alone, that was not going to work, Lansdale became increasingly attracted to the idea of a direct military invasion. And yes, he queried the Pentagon asking what sort of pretext could be devised in order to pave the way for that direct intervention. None of that came to pass because the missile crisis of October 1962, in essence, intervened and ultimately put a stop to the U.S. plans to invade.
Well, here we have, there's two different interpretations of President Kennedy. One is kind of, I guess, in your book and people like Noam Chomsky. And the other is in a book called Brothers by David Talbot. And in that book, he's basically saying that Kennedy had to kind of go behind the backs of the Joint Chiefs, that he opened up these kind of secret lines of communication with Khrushchev and with Castro because he couldn't do it out in the open, that he had to throw a little meat to the military now and then, and that Mongoose is one of them, and that he was sort of certainly in favor of the empire, but he was a little more rational about it, which really enraged some of the ultras.
I haven't read that book. I would say that the evidence that I know of with regard to Kennedy really is quite mixed. I don't think there's any evidence that suggests that he ordered the initiation of Mongoose because he was trying to provide a sop to the military. I think there's plenty of evidence that he and Robert Kennedy both felt the humiliation of the Bay of Pigs so strongly that, in a sense, in typical sort of Irish Catholic, the Irish Catholic mentality was that they were going to get back at Castro, and they were personally committed to destroying the Castro revolution. That said, I think an argument can be made that Kennedy learned on the job, and that Kennedy's thinking about the Cold War and the Soviet Union were in the process of evolving. The famous American University speech that he gave after the Cuban Missile Crisis is an example of that. But that evolution of thinking never produced very much that was concrete. And there, I think, is where you bump into the problem of Vietnam. The Kennedy apologists want us to believe that the president had a plan to pull out of Vietnam. I find that
I think it was some argument, security memo 263 or something.
Yes, and then it's just some indication that he was toying with the idea of a partial withdrawal after he achieved re-election in 1964. Of course, the assassination makes it difficult for us to know how that planned out, but we have to balance that against some pretty damning evidence that he was committed to the war. First of all, he said that he was committed to the Vietnam War, and secondly, he increased the U.S. military presence in Vietnam from about 500 to 17,000 quote-unquote advisors, and he also expanded the role of those advisors so that in addition to advising, they were engaged in what by almost any definition would be called combat operations. So I find unpersuasive the notion that Kennedy was this enlightened, peace-loving statesman who's...
Well, not so peace-loving, just a little more rational is sort of the way it goes. But either way, I mean, what happened, well, whatever you think about Kennedy, the fact remains that after his assassination, the war did magnify a lot.
Oh, no question.
And so,
yeah.
You know, this, in a way, with
but
Kennedy...
But, you know, in a way, I wonder if we can find parallels with the present moment. You know, the majority of the American people who voted for Barack Obama did so with an expectation that he was going to chart a significantly different course on national security. He has not done so. I mean, he has escalated the Afghanistan war. He's made the Afghanistan war Obama's war. Now, it could be that he has done that under a certain amount of duress, but quite frankly, so what? If indeed he doesn't believe that the course we've been following post 9/11 is a good course, then he ought to have said that outright and argued to get us out of Afghanistan. Instead, out of whatever calculation, he's gotten us more deeply into Afghanistan. Kennedy did much the same with regard to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Well, so after Kennedy, you could almost read our history as different attempts to get away, to get around what's been called the Vietnam syndrome. Basically, we lost the war in Vietnam, and the strategists since then have been trying to sort of get past that, redeem their strategy.
Well,
or whatever.
I would argue that the Vietnam syndrome had a fairly short life. Matter of fact, I think it's one of the things I try to talk a little bit about in the book. That I think it's quite remarkable. On the one hand, especially for those of us of a certain age who experienced Vietnam directly, whether in serving in Vietnam or perhaps opposing the war, we all viewed the Vietnam War as this massively important episode in American history. I think what becomes quite clear in retrospect is it really wasn't all that important. It was not all that important in the sense that it had only a very brief and limited effect on U.S. national security policy. And by the time we get to 1980 with the election of Ronald Reagan, by the time we get to 1991 with Operation Desert Storm, the lessons of Vietnam are largely forgotten, and the so-called Vietnam syndrome, which supposedly caused us to exercise a certain amount of self-restraint in the use of force, well, that's basically gone by 1991.
Well, I just read the other day that the U.S. and Vietnam are engaging in some kind of joint naval operations in the South China Sea.
Well, and it seems to what's going on now is that there's some amount of concern in Washington about China flexing its muscles in a military way. For all kinds of historical reasons, the Vietnamese are wary of Chinese power. And I think that those two things come together to create incentives or opportunities for the United States and Vietnam in a modest way to make common cause. I think the bigger story in Vietnam is that once we got out of the way and the country united, It has, in its own way, however imperfectly, found its own path towards development. And one cannot help wonder if we just kept our hands off the place, if the progress that Vietnam has made would not have been made more quickly and at less cost both to the Vietnamese and to us.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we only have a few minutes left. Why don't we kind of jump ahead to Iraq and Afghanistan and then leave a little time for your sort of way out of this predicament.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go to Iraq and Afghanistan, which Afghanistan has become President Obama's war.
Yeah, I think the most important thing I would say in that regard is that if we take those two wars together, and one typically is thought of as Bush's war, the other has now become Obama's war, both of those wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, reflect a conviction that the concerted use of American military power can bring about fundamental change in societies on the other side of the world, and that supposedly those changes will make that part of the world less susceptible to anti-American jihadism. What we've seen, in fact, I think, in Iraq and Afghanistan is our ability to engineer that kind of fundamental political and social and cultural change is very limited, and the effort to do so exacts enormous costs. Mm-hmm. I mean, we spent at least $1 trillion on these two wars, probably $2 or $3 trillion, not to mention the lives that have been lost. So the Washington rules in the present moment don't work. They cost a lot of money. They're not keeping us safe. They're probably simply creating greater anti-American animosity.
And China's buying up the oil.
And it seems to me that it's time for us to consider an alternative basis of national security policy. And my argument is that instead of global military presence, we ought to define the principal duty station of the American soldier as being in America. Instead of configuring our forces for power projection, we should configure them primarily to defend us and our vital interests. And that rather than viewing war as an opportunity to bring about political change, we should adhere to the just war tradition in which war is a last resort and only justified in self-defense. That, I think, provides a foundation for realistic, sustainable policies.
Well, your book has been getting quite a lot of mention. Is this strategy, is your prescription getting any leverage in Washington?
Oh, no. And the reason it's not is because what I call the Washington rules, even if they don't serve the interests of the American people, serve the interests of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
It sustains the military-industrial complex, sustains the national security state, and so Washington is deeply invested in maintaining the status quo.
Thank you very much. We've been talking with Professor Andrew Basevich, a retired colonel and professor of history at Boston University and author of Washington Rules. And thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.